I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of March. In 1961, Martin Luther King said, "In our glorious fight for civil rights, we must guard against being fooled by false slogans such as right to work. It's a law to rob us of our civil rights and job rights. Its purpose is to destroy labor unions and the freedom of collective bargaining, by which unions have improved wages and working conditions of everyone. Wherever these laws have been passed, wages are lower, job opportunities are fewer, and there are no civil rights." There were 19 right-to-work states in 1961. There are now 24, probably soon to be 25, Wisconsin being the addition to the 24 states. And enough time has passed that we ought to be able to examine our wages lower, our job opportunities fewer. A sponsor of the Wisconsin right-to-work bill, Republican Representative Chris Kapinga, says eliminating the requirement that people pay private sector union dues provides the liberty to choose. He says, quote, "As history has proven, promoting individual liberty and freedom maximizes the prosperity of the individual and of society as a whole." Right to work this hour, as the Wisconsin legislature will no doubt approve the Wisconsin bill as early as Thursday. Why now? Why 25 states? Will it create more jobs? Will it lower wages of all workers? We'll have two guests with us this hour, and we'll have other viewpoints on this as the days go on. Sean Johnson is joining us at the top of the show. He is Wisconsin Public Radio's award-winning state capitol reporter, and we'll be talking about the hearing that was held last night before an assembly committee and last week's state Senate vote. A little bit later in the hour, the vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, who also is a former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. All hour, we'll be welcoming your phone calls. It's a topic where people have strong opinions on one side or the other, usually, so we entertain viewpoints from you at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, so leave messages in all of those places. We would like very much to hear from you. Hi, Sean. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
So the hearing went pretty late last night, huh?
It did, yeah. It started at 10 in the morning, and it was scheduled tentatively to wrap up at 8 o'clock. Unlike the Senate hearing, though, where the chair of the committee decided early on he was actually going to end the committee early, and you had a pretty raucous ending to that hearing. The chair of the Assembly Committee, Representative Andre Jacques, decided to keep this one going late, and if anybody who had signed up to testify by 8 o'clock was allowed to speak, he then let some Democratic lawmakers speak and kind of diffused the energy in the room.
Mm-hmm. Who testified, Sean?
By and large, it was union members who said that this right-to-work bill is something that they didn't ask for, something that they worry is going to hurt their unions and ultimately hurt their wages and their working conditions. The proportion of people who testified against the bill versus those who testified in favor of it was extremely lopsided. You did have a handful of people testify in favor of the bill. Most of them worked for groups or think tanks, many at the national level, who fight right to work or propose right to work laws in all states. And so you had, for example, one of the people who was here testifying in favor of this bill yesterday was also a big advocate for Michigan's right to work law and ran for Congress there as a Republican.
Mm-hmm. And there is little doubt that this will get through the Assembly, correct?
Yeah, I have not talked to anyone who seriously believes that this would not pass the Assembly. There's just, nobody's given any reason, real reason, to believe that it has any issue there. I think it's just a matter of how many votes it's going to get. There was one Republican who joined all Democrats in voting against it in the State Assembly, or the State Senate, excuse me. That was Republican Senator Jerry Petrowski, who just issued a written statement saying that, like Ronald Reagan, he spent many years in a union, and that he was worried this bill would be disruptive to the economy of the state of Wisconsin. You know, whether or not we have somebody issue a similar statement or make similar remarks in the Assembly, We'll see, but I think by and large Republican lawmakers there not only support this bill, but enthusiastically support it. And, you know, they talk about it in terms of a workplace freedom issue.
Mm-hmm. Some have criticized the legislature for making this go way too fast. There should have been more hearings, much more deliberation. Is that a fair criticism? Are most bills put together and passed this quickly or not?
You know, it's moving fast in that this bill basically didn't exist a couple weeks ago. I mean, Senator Fitzgerald came out a couple Fridays ago and just told everyone, look, I have the votes now. We're going to do this. We're going to introduce a bill at the end of the day, and we're going to hold a hearing next week, and the Senate's going to vote on it Wednesday. You know, I think that's when you had a little bit of shock, because I think people were expecting Republicans might do a right-to-work bill this session, but they thought they might wait until they fill a seat that was left vacant when Senator Glenn Grothman went off to Congress, that they might need that seat to have the votes. So when Fitzgerald came out and said, we're going to do this now, yeah, that was shocking. I think more shocking probably was that Governor Walker, just a few hours later, said, I will sign this bill when it comes to my desk. I mean, it's not shocking that he supports the idea of right to work, but Governor Walker had said for a few years, this won't get to my desk. It won't get to my desk. It's not an issue. Union said it was an issue. He said that was absolutely false, couldn't be further from the truth. So, I mean, he has said repeatedly, without saying he would veto it, he said repeatedly that right to work wasn't going to happen. But once it did, I think that was sort of the speediest thing about all this process, was how quickly the governor said, yes, I will sign that.
Why? Why did he say that, do you think?
Well, I mean, I guess couple reasons. He supports it in principle. He did sponsor a right to work bill as a member of the state legislature. Also, you know, he's running for president right now, and he's not running for president as a candidate who wants to try to hit that middle of the road in the GOP. I mean, he is on most issues trying to run to the right of many of his opponents, at least to the right of somebody like Jeb Bush. And so, you know, for him to say, I'm going to veto right to work, would have completely been out of character with the rest of his candidacy so far. You know, right to work is going to be popular not only with the base in the states where he has to have some early victories, it's also going to be popular with big Republican donors.
And tell me why the Republican members of the legislature are so keen on right to work. Why are they doing this now? What is it that they feel will happen positively to the state of Wisconsin as a result of right to work?
I can tell you what they've said. And, I mean, Senator Fitzgerald has said that this is something that they've talked about for years, that even though it's just coming up right now, this is something that they discussed when Governor Walker proposed Act 10. You know, this right to work is different than Act 10 in that it doesn't effectively end collective bargaining, you know, as Act 10 did for most public employee unions. Collective bargaining still exists under right to work, but right to work bills ban mandatory union dues in private sector businesses. And so the situation you're going to have is bit by bit, potentially. You'll have people come on board at union shops, and if they don't pay those dues, the union gets weaker, their bargaining position gets weaker, and it makes it harder for them to haggle with management.
And just a final question. I started with a quote, because I remember this quote, actually, from Dr. Martin Luther King back in 1961, and we were looking up 17 states had right to work. With Wisconsin, it'll be 25 probably by the end of this week, including Midwestern states, a labor stronghold for a long time. Michigan recently passed, Indiana recently passed as well. Why do you think passage of right to work in states that have traditionally been union strongholds?
That's the big question, because if you look at the map of right-to-work states, until recently, it was dominated by southern states and, you know, some western states, not West Coast states, but, you know, western states. And so for these Midwestern states now, Great Lakes states, to start popping up on that map, you obviously see a pattern here. Republican legislatures, Republican governors are in these Midwestern states, And actually, they've passed these laws in sort of a similar fashion. In Indiana, the governor there, Mitch Daniels, said he didn't want to support right to work. Then pretty suddenly he did. In Michigan, Rick Snyder said it wasn't a priority for him. It wasn't, wasn't on his agenda. Once the legislature put it there, he said, yeah, I'll sign this. In Wisconsin, Governor Walker said repeatedly, not on my agenda. I would think it'd be a distraction. Once it was put before him, he said pretty quickly, yeah, I'm going to do this. There's a pretty strong alignment between Republican governors and Republican lawmakers and the business lobby. And right now, that alliance is pushing right-to-work laws where Republicans are in power.
We have one phone call that will be pertinent for you. The others we will hold for our second guest. And let's take a call for Sean Johnson from Ray in Milwaukee. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
Go ahead, please.
Yes. I want to give people kind of a glimpse through the eyes of a former non-union worker who became a union worker 15 years ago. I used to work at a theater in Milwaukee that was non-union. That theater, the management, still charged the customer, you know, the client, the bands, and also still kept ticket prices high, and they charged union-scale wages and yet paid us half of that, like about 10 to 12 an hour. As soon as I joined the union in Milwaukee as a stagehand, my wages increased by $5 an hour. I was given health insurance, and we had retirement. But now Scott Walker, running on the fact that he said he was not going to touch that, he got a lot of union votes in the rural areas of Wisconsin. And I want to say, if the vote was held today, I don't think Scott Walker would win, because he would lose hundreds of thousands of union members who actually voted for him, who now feel betrayed. And we just want to say, the people that stood with the teachers, we told you so.
Do you have number breakdowns for the number of union households who voted for Walker in the last go-around, Sean?
I don't have it in front of me, but I remember from exit polling that there was, I mean, it was a significant number of union households that supported the governor. And that, I mean, that drove some Democrats nuts. They said, like, look, what's happening here with the public sector? This is going to happen to the private sector, too, with right to work. But, you know, it didn't exactly get people's attention. There have been union members who've testified at these hearings saying, hey, I'm conservative. I know a lot of people in my shop, a lot of the union guys in my shop are conservative, and we're not too happy about this. You know, whether or not anybody pays a political price for that, we'll see. I don't think it's an accident that Republicans are taking up this bill in March, the year before the election. I mean, that's a lot of time between when this is happening,
yes,
and when the election takes place, for people to kind of forget about it. I will say that in Michigan, just talking to a public radio reporter up there who covered Michigan's right to work debate and the fallout, I mean, that is a bigger union state than Wisconsin historically. And he said nobody paid a political price there for the right to work law in Michigan. So his thinking was, it speaks to the diminished number of union members that we have in society now, you know, nationally, but even in Midwestern states like Wisconsin and Michigan. And in Wisconsin in particular, the number of union households has gone down since Governor Walker took office, likely because of all the changes that were part of Act 10.
Mm-hmm. Sean, thank you very much for all of your reporting always and for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Sean Johnson, our guest, letting us know what's been going on in the Senate in Wisconsin and the Assembly with the hearings last night concerning right to work. It seems, well, a foregone conclusion that Wisconsin will become the 25th state in the country to be a right to work state. Our next guest thinks there are problems with being a right to work state, and this idea that jobs will be flowing into the state is an erroneous idea, according to our next guest. We will meet and start taking many of your phone calls. Please just be patient with us a while longer, and we will entertain many, many calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now is Ross Eisenbray. He's vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. He is concerned and knows a lot about labor and employment law, occupational safety and health, pension policy, and regulatory policy. He's a former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission, worked for many years as an attorney and legislative director in the U.S. House, committee counsel in the U.S. Senate, and has written many articles on a wide range of labor issues. This week, he wrote right-to-work laws designed to hurt unions and lower wages. And we'll be welcoming phone calls for Ross momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. Ross, thanks so much for being with us. Hi.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Let's start with a bit of a history lesson. In your piece you wrote this week, you say that right-to-work laws originally were designed by business groups in the 1940s. Why?
The National Labor Relations Act had spurred a huge wave of union organizing, and businesses were looking for ways to undermine the growing union strength, and they thought that right-to-work laws, state right-to-work laws, would be one way to do it. The federal government had sort of thrown its weight to supporting union growth, and so they went to, mostly in the South, to anti-union politicians and frankly segregationist politicians in the South to try to get laws that would slow union growth or weaken unions that were already there. And so they started even before the Taft-Hartley Act, which then in 1947 sort of authorized states to do this. Up to that point, it wasn't clear that states actually had the right under federal law to prohibit union security agreements. And so the Taft-Hartley Act then actually explicitly authorized it, and then there was a big wave in the late 40s and early 50s of, once again, mostly Southern but also Western states that passed these laws. Mm.
As you remind us in your piece this week, we've had enough years now with right to work in many states in this country, and we keep adding more. Wisconsin will be the next. We have enough time that we can look at the history of what's happened as a result of right to work. What has happened?
Well, it's a very mixed bag. I think that the long and the short of it is that anyone who claims that right to work leads to a great improvement in a state's economy or any improvement has no evidence to base that on. And on the other hand, I don't think you can say very much about the effect of right to work in hurting an economy beyond what it does to union density, to the number of union members and people covered by union contracts. And then there is an effect because of that on wages eventually, because I think everybody recognizes that what unions do is raise wages. They, on average, collective bargaining contracts provide wages 13 to 15% higher than non-union contracts, than wages that are paid to non-unionized workers. Union workers are more likely to have health insurance and employer-provided pensions. And so if unions are weakened, if unions are reduced in scope and power, wages will fall. And that's what we have found in work that our institute has done, that on average, wages in right-to-work states are $1,500 less than in non-right-to-work states. And pension benefits are provided about 5% less frequently, and health benefits are less frequent as well. So that at the, after looking at everything, job creation, unemployment, all the different things that you might measure, the only effect that we can find is lower wages, less unionization, and lower wages.
Lower wages for all, or just lower wages for union?
No, across the board. The unionized workers generally still do better, of course, but wages across the board are 3% lower, and that works out to about $1,500 per worker.
One of the arguments that has been used in favor of right to work in the state of Wisconsin, comparisons have been made with neighboring states, Michigan and also with Indiana, that we're competing with those states now for manufacturing jobs and in a desire to move industry to the state of Wisconsin, jobs to the state of Wisconsin. We simply can't be a union state if they're not.
Well, I think that that has always been the argument that has been made. It was the argument the governor made in Oklahoma back in 2001 when Oklahoma passed its law, and the result was that it didn't work. Oklahoma lost a third of its manufacturing jobs over the next decade, but, you know, that was because the national economy was losing manufacturing jobs. It didn't help or hurt in that regard. It didn't have any effect at all. And I think the same will be true for Wisconsin. There's no reason to think that businesses are going to move on that basis. In fact, there are surveys of manufacturers. They ask them, what are the factors that matter to you? And they list none of the top 10 is whether a state is right to work or not.
Hmm.
It just doesn't matter because, I mean, what difference would it make to an employer whether the workers in a bargaining unit where there is a union contract agree to require everyone to pay their fair share?
Well, Ross, why do you think it matters to businesses and to legislatures?
Well, I think it's mostly about politics. I think your reporter had it exactly right that Republicans see unions as their opponents, so that's why they mostly support this legislation, and they're spurred on by business groups who would like to see the whole country be non-union. They unions oppose them on a whole range of issues that they care about, whether it's raising unemployment insurance benefits and keeping the weeks, having a 26 weeks of benefits as opposed to 10 or 15, having a higher minimum wage, having paid leave, even having Social Security and requiring employers to pay their share of Social Security. Unions have always been on the other side of business groups, and so they have always looked for ways to undermine or, if they could, eradicate unions.
Ross Eisenberry is our guest, as the Wisconsin legislature is very close, maybe as early as Thursday, to becoming a right-to-work state. I know that many of you have thoughts and questions, and you're on different sides of the issue. We'd like very much to hear from you and get Ross's response. Ross Eisenberry is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute, a former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And we start our calls for you, Ross, with Ron in La Crosse. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, I read in an economics text from a course I took over 40 years ago, there's such a thing as an agency shop in right-to-work states where, an employee has a choice of either joining or not joining a union. The arrangement is that the non-union employees still have to pay union dues to the local because under federal labor law, the union negotiator, when he negotiates with the company's negotiators, he's negotiating for all the people, and the non-union people get the same wages and benefits in what they call an open shop or agency shop. And I was just wondering, this right-to-work law that they want to pass in Wisconsin, it gives the non-union employees the right to just forego any dues, I guess. I think that's going too far. If a union negotiator is negotiating for all the employees, I think the non-union employees ought to also chip in because they're benefiting from those negotiations.
Ross?
Well, that was I think the gist of that was right, but it was a little bit confused. Under federal law, even in non-right-to-work states, no one can be either forced to join a union or to pay dues if they object to paying the full dues that go to things like political activities and whatever ideological or social activities unrelated to collective bargaining the contract, enforcing the contract, processing grievances. That's all that the union can ever be, can ever require an employee to pay if they object. So that's the law in whether it's right to work or not. What right to work states say is, even though federal law requires the union to represent everybody equally and fairly and to process everyone's grievances the same and to bargain the same benefits for the workers, whether they're members or non-members, they can't, in a right-to-work state, require the non-members to pay their fair share. That's all that right-to-work does. In my estimation, it's designed solely to undermine the union's ability to finance its activities.
Thank you, Ross, very much for your call. Laura in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. I don't think right to work is of any choice at all, because it was mentioned during the assembly meeting yesterday that any employer that allows a union to exist as they do now could face criminal charges up to $9,000 or also up to 9 months in jail, something like that. I can't remember the specifics, but the employer themselves could be considered criminal if they allow a union to exist as they do now. So there is no choice in terms of how the unions can operate once this law goes through.
I'm not sure I got that, Ross.
I think that's exactly right. It criminalizes. But what we have now is a situation where employees democratically vote to elect a union, and then they decide on what they want to bargain with the employer. And if they say, we want the employer to agree with us that everyone who's covered by the contract has to pay their dues,
mm-hmm.
They can do that now in Wisconsin. But once this law passes, it becomes illegal. It's actually a criminal offense, both for the employer and the union, to negotiate such a contract, to make that agreement. So you might say, and I think it's fair to say, this is an infringement on the freedom to contract, that people who have been democratically chosen in their workplace agree with, you know, would like to agree with their employer to have this contract provision that says everyone must pay their fair share, but the right to work law will make it illegal, a criminal offense to do that.
So the $9,000 figures in how?
As a fine.
Okay. Thank you, Laura, very much for your call. Let's go next to Daryl in Couderay. Hi.
Hello, Kathleen and Ross. I don't agree with any part of right-to-work legislation, but it is the latest example of taking choices away from the American working people. America is a very symbol-minded country. We like mom, the flag, apple pie. We also like cowboys, and in my opinion, I would have to say that this is the cowboy way to get things done, and it's become the American way. As Kathleen has mentioned earlier in the show, Wisconsin will be soon number 25. Why? Because the cowboys have the ammunition through legislation to get or buy whoever or whatever the cowboys want, even if that constitutes ruining the American workforce and our way of life.
Thank you for your opinion, Daryl. I want to ask, in the context of numerous shows that we've done, Ross, on wealth inequality in this country, and it's so enormous, and real wages going down for workers in America also in the last 10 years or 20 years, significant loss of income from all people who are working. Doesn't it strike you as, and I'm wondering how this kind of legislation can pass, considering that the money in everybody's pockets is going down and keeps going down year by year. Doesn't this legislation run counter what's happening to the average worker?
Well, this legislation is why what's happening to the average worker is happening. If you look at a chart that shows union membership as a share of total employment, it's been falling for 50 years. And once it started falling, there was a lag, but once it started falling, then in the late 70s, the share of income that goes to the middle class started falling as well. And now we've published this in our State of Working America, which can be found online at epi.org, and we'll be publishing a little snapshot of this same thing tomorrow. It's just a complete total parallel. The lines fall together, middle class income declining as union power, union density and power declines. So, you know, anyone who supports right to work, in my view, is saying that's okay. You know, let's weaken unions further. Let's make it harder for middle class people to earn a decent living.
Let's go to another phone call. Daryl, thanks for your call. Pat in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right, Pat. How are you?
Oh, so I'm good. I just have to disagree. I mean, I just hear the same misinformation time after time when we have individuals on that are always against right to work. And, I mean, one of the things they say is if you look at non-right to work states, medium wages are higher, there's more benefits, et cetera, et cetera. You can't, you know, you can't compare Louisiana to Connecticut. The fact of the matter is, if you look at the baseline of right-to-work states versus non-right-to-work states over the past 10 years, compare job growth and medium wages in the non-right-to-work states, it is over twice as much in those to right-to-work states. In addition, your speaker said, well, businesses don't care. It's not even in the top 10. Well, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the biggest business group in Wisconsin, show that it's number one or number two on like 80% of their members. So, you know, the misinformation, it just gets tiring hearing it, and it's simply not true. And it would be nice if we could have a guest that would be pro right to work one time on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, we've had many, and we will on this show as well. I think, though, that Ross will cite studies that say exactly the opposite, Ross.
Well, as I said, we've looked at what the effect is on wages, and that's controlling for the cost of living in Louisiana, the mix of occupations in Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, these other states. Even taking those things into account, the effect of right to work is to lower wages by $1,500 per worker. Now, your caller might say, well, you know, recently right to work is doing better than, you know, right-to-work states are doing better. But, you know, 7 of the 10 states with the highest unemployment rates are right-to-work states. We've had right-to-work for 70 years, and yet we have, you know, you look at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development did a ranking of the American states by quality of life and well-being and found that the top 8 of the top 10 states are non-right-to-work states. 8 of the top, of the bottom states are right-to-work states, the worst states to live in. So, I mean, there's been plenty of time for right-to-work to work its magic, and it hasn't happened. And the fact that the Wisconsin, somebody in a Wisconsin
Manufacturing
Association says that right-to-work matters when they're trying to pass this bill, I discount completely. I mean, 10 years of national surveys of manufacturers show that right to work is not even one of the top 10 factors. And it makes sense. Businesses, when they move from state to state, they look for tax incentives, they look for markets, they look for broadband access and access to highways, they look for low energy costs, they look for, you know, any number of things. The quality of life of the managers who are going to have to work in that facility. They are not thinking about right to work.
I believe it was maybe in the paper that you wrote this week that you said, and maybe somebody can come up with a place, that you don't know of any business that has moved either to Michigan or Indiana because they're right to work.
Yeah. I mean, the governors there both said, as the caller did, that, you know, there are all these businesses aching to come to our state, but we're not right to work, and so they won't. And, well, they've had years now where they've 2 years in Michigan and 3 years in Indiana, and no one has been identified as a company that wasn't going to come until they changed the law, and then did. It's just a myth.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. William is next in Middleton. Hi, William.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My granddad and Gus Hallberg were the two men who spearheaded the 8-hour, 5-day humane work week up in the iron ore mines in 1907. If you will Google 1907 humane work week. Origins, 10,000 Finns shot. Of course, there were in Haymarket Square union members who tried to organize unions, and a number of those people in Chicago in 1850s were shot. And Australia was the first country to have, in 1851, an eight-hour day. I was shocked to find out now, and this is going to happen in Wisconsin, that the people who have to work now in Australia, 12-hour days. Can you imagine that? In other words, it's gone backwards in Australia. It's going to go backwards here.
All right, Russ.
Well, that's certainly a lot of passion, but, you know, when your recent state history is that you had Madison, I think, and maybe Milwaukee passing local ordinances for living wages and paid sick leave, and then the same forces that are behind right to work got state laws passed that take that right away and actually did roll back the clock. So I think it's a real worry that there is a movement, a large, well-organized business movement to turn back the clock, to undo the National Labor Relations Act and Fair Labor Standards Act, and it's a real problem.
We're also seeing a number of communities, Seattle, the one that comes to mind right away, that are raising the minimum wage, and communities are passing a raise in the minimum wage. Would this make up, do you think, for some of the wages lost as a result of losing union strength?
It would, actually. I mean, raising the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage is $7.25. So Seattle raising it to $15 an hour is making a huge improvement in workers' wages there, because it's not just everyone who made less than $15 who will get a bump. The people who are making just over it will also get a bump because they're supervising those workers and will have to be paid more. So, yes, that is, there are legislative responses that can make a difference, although, frankly, there's nothing that can substitute on a national scale for collective bargaining and the kind of power that unions used to have to raise wages for their members and everybody else.
We're talking about right to work this hour as Wisconsin becomes the 25th state very soon to have right to work legislation. Ross Eisenbray is vice president of the Economic Policy Institute. His areas are labor and employment law, occupational safety and health, pension policy, and regulatory policy. He's a former commissioner of the U.S. Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission, and we're welcoming phone calls from people who have all kinds of different viewpoints on this issue. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ross Eisenbray is our guest now, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. Randy in Keewaskum is next. Hi, Randy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, let's take a look at American Motors here in Wisconsin. They closed up long before anybody else because they had the highest paid workers in the automotive field, and as a consequence of that, their factory was the most backward plant in the country. You know, they couldn't compete because they couldn't put any money into the plant because everything went to the workers. And right now, our auto companies, one problem they have competing with the world is the fact that they've got so many retiree benefits that they're paying out that you've got, what is it, $6,000-$7,000 a car goes into that. And as far as I've talked to people that have tried to get the union to take the political part out of their dues, and it's a joke. The union, it's red tape, and nothing happens, and they keep the money and use it. Yeah, things are political. It's the unions and the Democratic Party, knowing that all the money goes to the Democratic Party from the unions, that don't want this to happen because, we can't funnel money away. The heck with people's right to choose if they want to be in a union or not. Let's force them into the union, and that's the whole reason for the federal card check. Let's twist their arms, get them to sign a card, and once they sign the card, the union comes in. Yeah, this takes the teeth out of card checks. So, yeah, the unions and the Democrats are furious.
Ross.
Well, I'd say everything this person just said was wrong. First, no one can be forced to join a union, whether there's right to work or not. People can be required, just as they are in a co-op association or a condominium association or, you know, any other kind of mutual organization that they're part of, they can be required to pay the fees and costs of the organization and the benefits that it brings to them. Now, as to the American auto industry, American Motors is a great example of the truth of what happened to the U.S. auto industry. American Motors made lousy cars. My family used to buy them regularly, and so I know. You know, going back to the Lark and the Pacer, there was a whole range of badly made cars that people didn't buy. And so American Motors went out of business and left the rest of the big three, who then ran into a lot of trouble for the same reason. They made bad cars that were poor quality, and the Japanese, when they came in, were making cars with excellent quality that took away about, you know, a third to a half of the American auto market. And wages was a very small part of the problem. Studies show that General Motors would have had to cut the price of its car by 50% to win back the consumers who left because of poor quality. And, you know, if the listener thought for a minute about German cars and their high quality, and then said, well, how can they do that when their wages are much higher than American wages? They have been, they still are. They're much higher than the UAW wages, and yet they still produce good cars because their management has been and always was dedicated to quality products.
Thanks very much for your call. Let's read a couple emails and respond to what you would like, Ross. Nancy sends this. Right to work and the other greater autonomy and freedom to choose policies are nothing more than advantaging the wealthy power brokers and leaving the rest to starve, living homeless under bridges, the ultimate result of the bait and switch sham that in fact results in less choice and less freedom. Gary, on the other hand, has said, how can you conclude that right to work neither helped nor hurt Oklahoma? I understand that jobs fell, but how do you know they would not have fallen further if they had not instituted right to work? Association doesn't always equal causation.
Well, I agree with the second point, which is actually what I was trying to say, that jobs did fall, but it was because, and manufacturing jobs in particular, but it was because that was happening across the economy. My only point was that right to work was not a panacea. It didn't prevent that from happening. I wasn't saying that it caused that to happen. And I think, you know, it's going a little far to say that right to work is intended to make us all homeless and living under bridges, but I think it is true that the purpose of right to work laws is to weaken unions who raise wages, and by weakening unions, wages will not be raised. They'll be stagnant as they have been, or they will fall. And, I think that is the ultimate purpose and the reason why the business community has always supported the national right to work effort.
Well, I'm wondering where the studies are that look at what happens to businesses where unions go away, where there used to be unions, and let's say they're making a little bit more money or about the same amount of money. What is the distribution of profits like? How does that change with right to work or with union states?
Well, that is what's been happening, that there has been a widening inequality in America as union density has fallen. And our estimate is that a third of this huge growing gap in between the very wealthy and the middle class is caused by the loss of unionization. But it's greater in states that have right to work than in states that don't have right to work, and it makes sense because, as I said earlier, what unions do when they raise wages, that money comes from someplace,
mm-hmm.
And part of where it comes from is well, I mean, it's often higher productivity, but it also comes from less money going to executives and shareholders. The profits are better distributed to the workforce. That's the point of a union.
Joe in Franklin, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
How is this right-to-work law in Wisconsin going to affect someone who's in a union that crosses state lines, like a UPS driver, AT&T worker, trucking company, something like that?
That's a good question. I think that it will, my guess, and this is only a guess, is that it will be where you're headquartered, where the business is headquartered, and that, you know, just the fact that one makes a delivery across state lines from Minnesota won't change the ability of an employer and a union in Minnesota to have that contract provision.
Okay, well, I mean, somebody in that union, you know, you'll always hear, like, the UPS workers are going to go on strike.
Mm-hmm.
Do they bargain as one collective group, or do they bargain locally?
No, they do bargain national contracts.
Would the person in that local have the right to, you know, opt out? Does it work the same way, you know, for a local union within the state or someone like them?
It will not be. I think that if you're employed by UPS in Wisconsin, that you will not, your union will not be able to enforce a union security clause and require you to pay your fair share of the cost of collective bargaining.
Hmm. Thanks for the call. Mike in Franklin, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a retired union member, as was my father. And the best thing that happened to me, I was messing around a little bit after high school. I tried college. It didn't work. My dad told me to go to a union shop. It provided for myself and my family as it provided for my dad. And I will stand behind unions till the day I die. Because what they did, they gave us a little bit of respect. I'm not a rich guy. I never was. But they gave us a little respect. We had a contract. We knew what our obligations were. And it made it a better place for all the workers in there. And our company was very successful. And I just wanted to, what I believe in is that all the people, okay, they should understand that unions help everybody. They don't just help the individuals in union shops. They help everybody. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the call. We haven't spent a whole lot of time. We have about a minute left. On, would you agree with him? And can you cite statistics that show how unions help everybody?
Well, I mean, one way is that in states, can I cite statistics? Well, it's always been the case that where there is greater union density, like in the auto, we'll just go back to the auto industry.
All right.
Where when the Japanese transplant companies started building factories in the United States, how did they set their wages? I mean, they could have paid anything, but what they chose to do was pay a wage very close to the UAW wage.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they wanted to attract good workers, and they knew that they would have to pay something close to what GM and Ford and Chrysler were paying if they were going to get them. And they didn't want people, frankly, to organize. So there was a sort of a union threat that they were responding to. And that's still the case today. Toyota, I think, pays, let's say, $25 an hour or $28 an hour, and General Motors is paying $28 or $29 to most of its employees. So you can see what the effect is of having a union right there.
Ross, thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate your time today.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Ross Eisenbray, Vice President for the Economic Policy Institute. He wrote a piece this week, Right-to-Work Laws Designed to Hurt Unions and Lower Wages. As you know, the Wisconsin Assembly will be voting on right-to-work probably on Thursday of this week, and there's little doubt that it will pass. We will hear other perspectives on right-to-work, but we thought that this, because it's likely to pass in Wisconsin, that we wanted to hear this viewpoint, and we'll hear others as well. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We're going to be talking about same-sex marriage and what has happened just in the past 7 years on this issue, to the point where probably it will be declared the law of the land in all states in the not-too-distant future. That's coming up.